Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I wrote the Dog Bible, Everything Your Dog Wants You to Know, as well as the Cat Bible, Everything Your Cat Expects You to Know. This episode features one of three guests who were part of my weekly hour-long NPR show broadcast over the air every Sunday on WLIW-FM 88.3, the only NPR station on Long Island where it has broadcast continuously for over 15 years. This show is about dogs, cats, and other creatures who share the planet with us. Please check out my other Pet Talk podcasts at TracyHotchnerPets.com. This show would not be possible without the longtime support of Woruva, the pet food company founded and privately run by David Foreman, who named it after his rescued kitties, Webster, Rudy, and Vanessa. Woruva is a quirky name for a company with whimsical names for the dozens of different cans and pouches of cat food they make. But what sets them apart is how serious David is about high-quality nutrition. They were the first pet food company to use human edible ingredients and process them in the same facilities that make human food, remaining privately owned and run, accountable only to their own high standards. This show is also made possible with the generous support of Dr. Elsie's, the privately owned litter and cat food company founded by Dr. Bruce Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian. He personally created many styles of litter to make sure that even the fussiest cats would not have out-of-litter box problems, the number one reason people abandon their kitties. Dr. Elsie also created his own brand of cat food called Clean Protein, the first dry cat food I can recommend because it's based on the protein found in a cat's natural prey. Dr. Elsie's is also the founding and continuing sponsor of my New York Cat Film Festival, of which I am the founder and director, along with the annual New York Dog Film Festival, which premiere in New York City every October and then travel the USA and Canada supporting local animal welfare groups. Go to dogfilmfestival.com and catfilmfestival.com to find out when we'll be where. Boy, do you have a treat in store, people. This book is called Dogland: Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Tommy Tomlinson wrote it. He's already famous for writing a book that I wasn't aware of, but it got all kinds of attention, called The Elephant in the Room: One Fat Man's Quest to Get Smaller in a Growing America. And I thought, well, this is a leap. I mean, now he's going to just write about Westminster. Tommy, you have a view of America, of the world, of humans, that is somehow you strike the perfect tone between joy and empathy and snarkiness and observation that could even tilt into criticism, and all the while just take us along for a ride in this book that isn't just about the Westminster Dog Show, or even just about dog shows, although it's really great and funny about dog shows. It's about everything about people and dogs, but seen through this lens of yours that's absolutely unique. It really is quite extraordinary. The book knocked me off my pins. I started to read. I thought, well, I'm interested in dog shows, and I know a fair amount, and I'm sure Tommy learned more than I know. But what you learned about all kinds of dogs and all kinds of dog people, no wonder you spent so many years doing this book. I mean, it could be three times thicker, right? I mean, you must have had to leave out a lot of really good stuff.
I did. I had to leave out a lot of stuff. You know, I was on the road. First of all, thank you for all the compliments. That's very nice. And it was up to me. We just end right here and let that go. But I left a lot kind of on the cutting room floor because I wanted to make sure the story moved pretty quickly and that we didn't dwell too much or get too bogged down in a lot of the details of dog shows or the conflicting sort of theories on how dogs and humans got together. There's a lot of that stuff out there, and I hope
that's right
for people who are interested in that sort of thing, that maybe this is a kind of a springboard to go a little deeper on those things. But what I wanted to do mostly is sort of explore the kind of the subculture of dog shows. I always love going into a world that I don't know much about and sort of being a translator for everybody else to kind of say, okay, here's this little weird world that you may have seen from the outside in something like, you know, the movie Best in Show or whatever, and kind of tell you what it's really like in there. And then to explore a little further about maybe why the people who are so devoted to dogs and so interested in them, why that is. And for me, that comes to kind of a deeper thought and understanding about what dogs mean to us and what we mean to them.
Well, you certainly have it, but you don't preach. You know, I think one of the, I'm going to call it problems with all the serious PhD kind of books out there, or people who it was their doctoral thesis about, you know, sure, how do we evolve together and what is the meaning of the animal-human bond and what is unconditional love? It's a little dry and it's a little pedantic and it's a little takes itself so seriously. And I think what I most admire about this book is that you neither take yourself seriously nor all the many kinds of people you're writing about, including going back to the 1800s. Great anecdotes. I mean, honestly, you're a good finder of stories, but the way you tell them, it's the tone. I realized that no one else could have written this book but you, and I don't know you. And I didn't read your book, The Elephant in the Room. But no sooner had I just dug in a little bit than I thought, this man's voice and vision is both loving and mocking lovingly at the same time. So that whatever somebody might come to this book with an attitude about, oh, breeding dogs is stupid or terrible or, you know, unkind or a waste of time and energy and money, or they might think, wow, you know, dog breeding and shows is just a beautiful way for people to, indulge themselves in something they care deeply about. You let the reader kind of come along with you and chuckle at things, but also look a little deeper into the tears of joy and excitement that you see on a lot of people's faces when they're going through the ups and downs of dog showing, which you neither revere nor extol nor criticize it. You just are an observer, which I think is the best kind of writing, isn't it? Just observing the human condition as seen in this little microcosm.
I think where that comes from for me is the realization that we all have something that we deeply care about that might seem silly to other people. Everybody has some little subculture you're part of, whether you're a chess player, or you fish, or you love to knit, or whatever it is, something that to a lot of outsiders, people think, well, why would you want to devote your time and effort and money to that thing? But you know, in the middle of it, it's totally understandable and explainable. And so I think a lot of people look at dog shows, which are kind of these weird little beauty pageants, you know, and in some ways, and they dogs are shown in these dog shows in very different ways than they are just in the normal world as pets or companions or whatever. And people look at that, I think, a lot and go, well, that's silly. That's kind of dumb or goofy or whatever. But the people who are in it see all the reasons why they want to do it this way and why it makes sense to them. And so that's what I love. That's the kind of thing I love writing about, is taking that world and explaining it to other people. And that comes from, you know, kind of the knowledge of that we all have our own thing. I think the tone and the, you know, sort of trying to explain it to people and have empathy comes from, I was a newspaper columnist for a long time. And my job 3 or 4 days a week was to sort of try to explain things that are going on in the world in a way that's accessible. It also makes clear as an observer, sort of by the facts I choose or what I tend to say, kind of how I feel about it, but also to kind of show you what it's like and help you make your own decisions. And so that experience, doing that for years and years and years, really helped me in terms of tackling larger projects like this book and figuring out how to explain this world to kind of a bigger audience.
I knew you'd been a journalist, but I wondered if you were a sports journalist, because I think it's sort of universally known, at least among writers and journalists, that maybe the best writers in terms of the most creative writers as journalists are the sports writers, because mm-hmm. they have to describe something that everybody already saw or thinks they understand completely, basketball game, soccer, whatever it may be. But they always can sort of... like turning a mango skin inside out, right? And there's that kind of pit in the middle and most of the meat sticks to the skin. Mangoes are tricky fruits. And I've always thought that journalism, sports journalism writing, is like that. How to make something fresh, interesting, and usually quite funny and insightful while telling people something that they sort of thought they knew something about already. And I think that's what you do, because you take stories like something I'd forgotten. You have a whole chapter on the trouble with Frenchies. And people in the know in the dog world know that there's terrible problems with French bulldogs. They've become the most popular breed, which is a curse on them, as it has been on other breeds in the past. And they're bred in often terrible places and trucked around in nefarious ways. And there's very few at this point really good, responsible Frenchie breeders. But everybody wants them and they spend insane amounts of money for them. And they have terrible medical problems. So those are just the facts that are out there. They're kind of irrefutable. But on the other hand, they're now the most popular dog. And I'd forgotten that Lady Gaga's dogs had been dognapped and her dog walker hurt. The story you tell about it, Tommy Tomlinson, is so good. I mean, it should be, you know, a magazine, a central magazine piece all by its own. It's just great. I mean, you look at it and you'd say, I don't know, your writing is just so clever and so engaging. And there's a story we all thought we knew. Oh, yeah, that's right. That guy got shot and poor Lady Gaga, or poor him, or poor dogs. It all had a happy-ish ending. But the story you tell of it, which is only an aside, a throwaway, as you're going to, you know, as you go to tell us how Frenchies overtook Labrador Retrievers as the most successful dogs, when you must have had just reams of research, stories, anecdotes on topics that overlapped, many overlappings, I'm guessing. The putting together of it had to be a crazy quilt. The book is a crazy quilt. You say a narrative, and yeah, there's a great narrative of a Samoyed handler, breeder, and this dog, Striker. And I've known some Sammies, weirdly enough. I interfaced with a Samoyed breeder and handler at Westminster, I don't know, it's got to be 15 years ago, when the Dog Bible came out, and she invited me to sell copies of the Dog Bible near her area, which was underneath in the bowels of the Hotel Pennsylvania. Her area turned out to be where the dogs went to poo and pee. This was not a place to sell a book, Tommy. I mean, too bad I didn't tell you this story, because you would. It's a very Tommy Tomlinson story. So the people handling, as you know, and describe in wonderful detail in the book, people handling the dogs at a dog show aren't the owners. They're paid handlers. And when they take them to this designated area to poo and pee, they're hoping they can get that job done in an odd space that has some sawdust on the floor and other dogs scent in it. Those handlers not only are on that task and wondering how many other dogs they have to handle that day and the next in the show, they need a copy of a book called The Dog Bible, Everything Your Dog Wants You to Know. Like, they need a third leg. I mean, it was ridiculous. But this woman had Samoyeds, so I was really familiar with Sammies and the Sammy smile. She even tried to entice me to get some very wealthy friends of mine in Bel Air, California, who happened to own a pet Samoyed, to invest in her show dog. And I actually floated the idea to them. I was such a sucker. Luckily, they weren't suckers. But this dog, Striker, whose story you have weaved through the book, it's a great story. And this dog is a very great dog. And I think he exemplifies what makes show dogs tick and what makes a show dog, and you're very clear about it, and you describe it really well. If they don't want to do it, not only are they not going to do it, but they're not going to win, and that'll be that. They get weeded out because it doesn't give them joy to do this quite physically and mentally intense job, and it is a job, and that's their whole job. You tell a very funny, one of the millions of funny anecdotes. There were three famous herding breeds that were at a dog show and some prey got loose and all, or was it a sheep? No, there were sheep that were loose.
Tell the story.
It's so funny.
Well, it was an event they did at a park to sort of showcase the herding dogs and things like that. And so they put some sheep and stuff out in a park. This is in D.C. And the herding dogs had no idea what to do with these animals. They had
never seen one.
Been they had been show dogs or purebreds for so long and had never been in the field that I think people assumed their just instincts would kick in.
Yes.
Or their DNA.
Yeah.
And they would do it, but they had gotten so far removed from what they originally were meant to be that they had no idea what to do. And that's, you know, just the evolution of how we've come to see what we see dogs as. Their usefulness has changed so much over time. In the beginning, they were basically power tools. You know, we crafted dogs, we bred dogs to pull heavy things or to hunt game or to, you know, guard castles and that sort of thing. Now, 30,000 years later, as I say in the book, most dogs are basically therapy dogs. Now they're companions, they're housemates, they're our friends. And the incredible adaptability of the dog is that they've managed to figure that out along the way and adapt to our needs in the same way that we have adapted to theirs. And it's no other animal on earth really has adapted in the same way. Dogs have become useful to us in a whole new way than they were at the beginning.
And when you tell that, though, you don't tell it like a college professor or somebody who, you know, wants to prove to you how smart he is, Tommy Tomlinson. You tell it with stories. And I think this is an incredible, you know, if we, in fact, we as humans started our lives around campfires, right? Oral history, telling stories. That's how we imparted a sense of history and knowledge and, you know, how to handle a situation that might upcome in your life, you tell it as a story. And I feel as if all these stories are so enriching in understanding things that I knew them in that intellectual way. I've done the research. I've interviewed people who've done the research. And it was all just kind of dry. And your book is just the juice and the sauce and the icing and the cherry on top. It's everything anybody has ever known about dogs, but told through this lens of individuals and their juicy stories. It's really wonderful. Well, and your observations, they're so great. I didn't even ask you ahead of time, but is there any chance you can reach to your left or right and have a copy of your book?
I do. I have it right in front of me.
Awesome. Okay. Can you open to page 18? So page 18 is one of the very first times that you describe Stryker, the pure white, black-eyed, black-nosed Samoyed who won and won and won. A couple of times he was bumped out of a best in show by, I don't know, Wasabi, or who was a Pekingese, and I'm sure we all could have opinions about a dog that can barely walk, much less waddle. But he got beaten a couple of times, and you talk about the poodle who got booed when a golden retriever might have won. It's great. You make it all such a crowd-pleasing event. Can you read – this is just to give people listening a sense of the beauty of your language and the power of your observation. And it just elicits so many chuckles. So if you start with the bottom line is all this takes a while, you've explained – you know, in very briefly, a few paragraphs, how long it takes to run any dog show, all the various categories until you get to best in show. So if you could start with bottom line and just end on the next page, he would have made a hell of a point guard. This is about this wonderful, gorgeous white Samoyed who clearly was born to do this job, be a show dog and be a breeding dog as well.
Right. So I've been describing, as you said, kind of the judging process for any breed.
Yes.
The bottom line is all this takes a while. The rule of thumb for breed judging is 2 minutes per dog. With 26 dogs, it'll take about an hour to whittle down the Samoyeds. For their dogs and the handlers, most of that is waiting. Stryker is fantastic at waiting. Most of the other dogs keep looking up at their owners, pleading for scritches or treats. Stryker seems to barely notice what's going on. When Laura tells him to be still, he stares off into the distance. His normal stance is an almost perfect stack, the kind of pose it can take a show dog months to learn. One of the defining traits of the Samoyed is something called the Sammy smile. The theory goes that as the breed evolved in the bitter Siberian winters, the corners of its mouth began to turn upward so its drool wouldn't leak out and freeze. People talk about their dogs smiling all the time, but the Samoyed is one of the only dogs that can actually form a smile, even with its mouth closed. What that means, when Stryker is standing still and staring into the distance, is that it looks like he's reliving a fond memory, like a choice piece of steak or an especially pleasurable hump. He takes quick, short breaths that make him look like he's nodding to an EDM beat. Oons, 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 oons. This is a part of show quality, too. Most of the dogs that win dog shows aren't jumpers, at least not in the ring. They have an inner stillness that I tend to associate with people who are either enlightened or empty-headed. Al McGuire, the great college basketball coach, used to say he didn't like really smart players. They were too aware of the crowd and the noise to play with the proper focus. This is not to say Stryker isn't smart. It's just to say he would have made a hell of a point guard.
This is why this book is so precious. It just, it weaves together so many things in that small amount. History, you know, genetics and another sport. And our perceptions all the time that our dogs are smiling. And the idea that this mouth evolved in a Siberian winter, it's like, wow. Now, as I said about your research, it's seamless. I don't ever get the sense of, oh, yeah, Tommy wanted to put in that thing about, you know, Samoyed breeding ideas or where they – it's just – it's natural in that part of the story. It's like you parked everything in your brain and it just flowed out at the right time in a way to just make us stop and think, wow, that's right. Those dogs that are so great in the show ring, they're different than everybody else. They're just special, like a point guard.
Right, and I think part of that – figuring out how to do that is a matter of making the right choices.
Yes.
So as you said, there's a ton of material on dogs, on the history of dogs, on dog shows. I mean, I've got a bookshelf full of books and probably read thousands of articles, you know, academic and otherwise. And so, gathered all the information, looked at all that information, and then it becomes a matter of trying to figure out what story you're trying to tell and which of the facts that you have at hand can best tell that story.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of stuff that I really worked hard to get or information that it took me a while to track down is not in the book because in the end, it just didn't fit the story I was telling at the moment. And so that, I think, for any writer, any, you know, person who does kind of artistic or craft type work, you know, there's this letting go of something that sometimes you worked really hard to get because it doesn't fit what you're trying to do in the moment. And so that's a hard-earned lesson.
That's right.
For me, because when I was early in my career, I wanted to show off what I'd learned. And so I would put stuff in there that didn't really fit just because, by golly, I wanted you to know I worked to get this.
Yes.
And now I'm much more attuned to what the story needs instead of kind of what my ego needs.
I think that's exactly right. And that's what I was most struck with, what you had left out, things I'll never know, because what you picked are gems and they're just in the right place in every case. There's so many things you talk about. You talk about the semen collection at dog shows and the two women who give hand jobs to dogs at dog shows for $250-something dollars a pop, and then these are put in straws, and the people keep them maybe forever, and the dog is long dead, but he could still be bred if he wound up later to be a grand champion, and his semen would be worth more within his breed. It's like you there's no stone you left unturned. One thing you brought up, which is really relevant, is why do people wear such ugly clothes in dog shows? The handlers, they look so dumpy. In fact, I was once told there's just a couple of stores, and I don't know where they are, that sell these pretty dreadful looking skirt suits to women, because you'll never see a woman wearing those skirt suits in real life, I don't think. Now, you live in North Carolina. Maybe ladies who lunch wear kind of those kind of skirt and jacket suits. I don't know. But
yeah, not really,
right?
Not often, but Well, no, and so there's a couple of issues that especially women who are dog handlers have to deal with. One is that they need to be wearing flats because That's part right. of their job is running around the ring. And so the types of outfits that look good with flat shoes are pretty limited. And in fact, sometimes there aren't any really good ones. If you're wearing sort of clunky shoes, there's no outfit that looks good with those. And so that is sort of a limiting factor. The other thing is they're taking these dogs around the ring and they're being with them all the time. They have to have somewhere to stash treats because dogs want treats. And so they look for things with pockets. And as any woman knows, clothes with pockets are pretty scarce for women. And some women stuff the treats down in their bra. Some women and men handlers actually leave the treats in the mouth, like a
in their own mouth, yeah,
in their own mouth, like a hunk of chewing tobacco. And so, the bottom line of that is that the range of clothes that are that look good and are functional for a woman in the dog handling business is pretty narrow. And so you end up with people who do wear clothes that don't look great on. The other factor in that is sort of the theory about should you deliberately wear kind of bland looking, unappealing clothes so that the judges aren't looking at you, they're looking at your dogs.
Right.
Yeah, that's the kind of theory too. If some handlers wear very dazzling looking clothes, and the idea that if you remember the handler, you might also remember the dog, other people's theory is completely opposite. They want to wear as bland a looking outfit as possible so that the judge's focus is completely on the dog. And so there's all these things that sort of conspire, I think, to make it hard to look good as a dog handler, especially if you're a woman.
And you explained it all. And there's just two very funny lines. We've only got a minute left. But when you describe about these shoes and they have to have a grip and the last thing you want to do is fall in the show ring. And then you just throw in this anecdote. In 2021, Westminster's agility competition, a separate event from the main dog show, a handler fell and nearly squished his Boston Terrier named Ripple. The video got 500,000 views on YouTube. This is not how you want to get 500,000 views on YouTube. You throw away right. these things. It's like, whoa, squished, Ripple, YouTube. It's like, okay. And then you say about the handlers wearing glittery outfits. I saw one handler who had basically dressed as a piano, black pants, glittery white sport jacket, and one of those ties with piano keys. It'll be a long time before I forget that handler, but I can't remember a single thing about his dog. I just want to say, Tommy, this book had so many lines that I was underlining. I didn't know where to begin or where to end. It was sort of like, okay, Tommy should just come on and read the whole book because there's nothing in it that's fluff or not interesting. It's all riveting and fun and funny. We've run out of time, but I just, you know, whether you guys go to dog shows, watch dog shows on TV, even if you think dog shows are not good for dogs or people, there are people who want to have that opinion. Please get this book. You'll have such a great time. Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show. Tommy Tomlinson, this is a fantastic book, and you have done credit to everyone you spent time with, whether they were four-legged or two-legged. Thank you for the wonderful work you put in creating it.
Oh, my pleasure. This was a treat. Thank you so much for the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed the show. There were a few more special companies that make this show possible, and I hope you'll try their products because they support my mission to entertain you with valuable information and advice. This show is supported by Earth Animal, which is privately owned by Dr. Bob and Susan Goldstein, where they create holistic pet wellness products with an emphasis on their stewardship of the Pet Sustainability Coalition. Earth Animal makes a dazzling array of healing products for dogs and cats, as well as the innovative dog chew, No Hide, and the hybrid dry food, Wisdom, which is sometimes all that my picky Weimaraner Maisie will eat. The show is also brought to you in part by Evermore Pet Food, privately owned by two dedicated women who take human edible, ethically sourced ingredients to gently cook dog food that is then frozen in pouches and shipped right to your door. They founded and run their own company and answer to their own high standards without interference from venture capital investors. My dogs love it every single day.